Hello and welcome to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And I'm John McCoy.
And we are here to talk about the works of children's author Beverly Cleary.
Beverly Cleary, who just had her 100th birthday earlier this month.
Right, so it's as good a time as any to pick up her first books and take a look at her career.
This podcast has been germinating in our heads for some time. It turns out that Phil and I both have strong memories of reading Beverly Cleary as kids, and we both have kids to whom we have read Beverly Cleary.
Right, right. I first read Beverly Cleary pretty much at the age you're supposed to start reading Beverly Cleary in elementary school. It was Ramona the Pest was my first chapter book I ever read.
Right. Well, I actually have a delightful story about the first book I ever read by Beverly Cleary. It was, in fact, Henry Huggins, her first book. I was at a library sale. They were selling their discarded books, and I came across a library-bound copy of Henry Huggins. I had never heard of this book before in my life, but I was immediately struck by the Lewis Starling illustrations, and I bought the book, and I still have that book today. The pages on it are so grubby and worn. They feel like a cotton t-shirt or something. But I love the book very much. Additionally, I also, at that yard sale, I got a aloe plant for 15 cents. And for the next 20 years of my life, we seem to have descendants of that one aloe plant growing somewhere in my house.
Well, that was a fruitful sale.
It was, and then after I read Henry Huggins, I immediately went to try and find every other book I could from her. Now, this was back in 1975, so a lot of the Ramona books hadn't been written yet at that point. A couple had, but I read all the Henry Huggins books. I read all of the Ralph Mouse books, and I'm ashamed to say that as a young boy, I didn't much care for Ramona because I thought, who is this girl coming in and taking over the series?
Well, it's funny because on my side of it, I read Ramona first, and I had very little interest in Henry Huggins because he was introduced to me as just the sort of older, distant, unknowable character, because I learned about him from Ramona's perspective. So I wasn't really interested in what he was up to so much as Ramona's relationship with him.
I did then go back and read the books to my kids. And when I read them in the early 90s to my kids, I discovered what everyone really knows, which is the Ramona books are sort of the pinnacle of Cleary's career. Although, well, there's books like Dear Mr. Henshaw too, but the Ramona books are on such a different psychological level than the Henry Huggins books, and it's fascinating to read these books, I think, in sequence to see how that happened.
Now, that's what I did when I recently, just in the last year, read them to my younger child, which was, I was like, well, I want to go through and I want to read them in chronological order because that's the best way to sort of not only hear the story, but also see how Beverly Cleary develops as a writer. And I was really struck, always having been aware that there was a continuity running through the books, I was struck by how developed the characters are from the beginning, and then also how they grow inwardly and outwardly, like as the story progresses.
One of the things that also you and I have talked a lot about is the way that the books develop from their origins in the 1950s through the 60s and 70s and on into the 90s when Cleary stopped writing, and how wonderful the books are as a time capsule for those times, and how sad it is that the publishers have attempted to update the books by adding new illustrations or by changing references to, say, the price of items in the books, because the books do kind of exist in that weird nebulous region that sometimes multi-decade spanning properties like The Simpsons exist in that they intersect in a weird way with the culture around them.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know, she said that the two things she was never going to do was follow trends and let money influence her writing, like let money influence what she was going to write about. But it interests me then in the sense that the books are clearly set in the decades in which they're written. The Ramona books follow a very strict continuity, but they are like the ones in the 50s take place in the 50s and so on. Like the references, the styles, the things the kids do. And so when you say like they're a time capsule of that era, it's true. Like you are aware that these stories are taking place in the past, but also in a very specific time in the past. Even though she doesn't pepper them with a whole lot of pop culture, there's just enough to place them. And I think that the part of the genius in her writing is that she can maintain the integrity of these characters, but not force them into a time period that she's constantly writing for the children of the time she's writing for, without kowtowing to popular demand. So she's not trying to write for the kids who grew up with the previous books. She's writing for the new generation of children. And so she's setting her books in the era in which they are familiar. Does that make sense?
One of the things that's interesting reading these books now is you look back on them and they are, while they really do capture the essence of childhood lived experience, they may not strike a modern reader as innovative the way that they actually were, which is important to remember that she herself said that she wrote the books because she wanted to have books about the real experience of childhood rather than what children's literature was at the time. And Beverly Cleary had spent time as a children's librarian, and she said that all the books were Little Lord Fauntleroy at that point. That was
right.
Basically, you know, British stories taking place either in Victorian times or Edwardian times and completely divorced from the experience of the American child.
Also at the time, we were looking at a period where there was a sudden explosion in youth culture, and there were so many kids coming out of the post-war era, and children's publishing itself was exploding. There were just hundreds upon hundreds of children's books. There was a huge demand for children's literature at the time Henry Huggins was published. But a thinness in as far as stuff that was written about kids, how they were. We were coming off of an era where books were telling children what they were supposed to be like in these sort of moralistic tales. These, you were kind of idealizing youth. You were showing children what they were supposed to aspire to be, and we were right on the verge of this weird realism where Beverly Cleary came in right at the crest of it, saying, "Let's write books that respect children and let them see themselves on the page. Let them see their own worries, their own anxieties, their own realities living on the page, because that's really what kids are demanding. They're tired of being talked down to." And even as a children's librarian, she was well known for her ability to speak to children the way they wanted to be talked to, which was as equals.
As you mentioned, there was this explosion at the time of children's literature. Books for children were largely purchased by libraries. They were published in small batches, and it wasn't until the baby boom got really underway that there was a lot of books being bought by consumers. The golden books that we all know, the Dr. Seuss, I Can Read books, there was this huge explosion of books for young readers. And Cleary was one of the first to write these books for the older child reader. I mean, there were obviously books that had been written in the 30s and 40s, but nothing sold at the way that it did in the post-war period.
Right, there was no such thing as young adult fiction.
That's an interesting point, too, because Cleary went on to write a few books for teen readers. Those aren't as well remembered, and in some ways they're kind of dated more than the Henry Huggins books. I don't know what that means. Maybe that simply means that the teen culture has changed more in the time, or maybe it was, these are very psychologically acute books, but I have a hard time imagining Cleary doing like what Judy Blume did, which in another 20 years, and write both books for little kids and then like very, you know, relevant books for teens.
Well, there is a sparseness to her writing. It's been pointed out that Beverly Cleary doesn't go in for description. She doesn't embellish her writing at all. It's very straightforward, which I think is a style that benefits books for children. But when you get to the teen mindset, I think that teens might look for something a little bit more indulgent, a little bit more. I mean, teens are a little more dramatic. They want something with a little more flair. I think Blume was better at that, capturing that essence of what a teenager wants in writing than Cleary, who is more reserved, who flits around the edges of psychology, which is amazing in a children's book, but I think for a teenager might, well, we'll get to it in a later episode, of course.
Okay. We intend to try and read through all of Beverly Cleary here in order. We'll try and do this one book a podcast. We'll see how that works. There may be some books we skip. Cleary.
There are some books that are hard to get your hands on.
Cleary apparently wrote three books for the Leave It to Beaver property, for example. I think we can safely skip over those, but we'll read what we can. For those of you who know us from our respective other podcasts, this is assuredly a side project, and we will try and stick to once a month as long as it doesn't kill us.
Yeah.
So, do you want to talk about Henry Huggins?
Let's talk about Henry Huggins. I'm eager to get into this book because I've read it twice now in the last month, and three times in the last few months, and I've got some thoughts on it.
Okay. Well, Henry Huggins starts out with Henry Huggins in the third grade living on Klickitat Street in Portland, Oregon.
A very real place.
I don't think there had ever been a book up till this time set in Oregon for kids. I can't.
Right.
And, you know, when I was a kid and they talked about Klickitat Street, I assumed that was a made-up name.
I had no idea it was a real place, probably until just the last few years I bothered to even look it up, because it sounds like a made-up street name you would put in a children's book.
And in many ways, it starts out like a book for a kind of a standard book for kids. But I would say from the beginning, you know, there are a lot of things that mark this book as taking place in the 1950s.
Especially in
this first chapter. I mean, a lot hinges upon the fact, for example, that Henry has to make a pay phone call and he has to make decisions on how he's going to use the available coins he has on hand.
Well, just the very fact that Henry is out by himself eating ice cream, he's got errands to run, he's expected to take the bus home. And he's 7 years old?
Yeah. Now, this is a really good point to make here. You know, there's a lot of talk amongst parents these days about free-range kids, about whether or not kids have been too sheltered, or that their time is too monitored all the time. Kids could today, if you sent a kid out on a bus at Henry's age, you would have Child Protective Services at your door that afternoon, and
right, or you'd at least get some pretty strong looks.
I mean, I read this book in 75. I did have a childhood where I was given free rein to go around within a 3-block radius of my house. I did not have the same kind of free rein that Henry had, so I could see it shrinking in, and of course today you know, my kids never went out of the house without me.
Well, you learn a lot just from the first few pages of this book. You learn that Henry is smart. He's very pragmatic. He's good. He's a forward thinker. Like he thinks about money. He stops and considers things before he does them. You learn that he's a lonely kid, that he's kind of isolated because you are introduced to him by himself. He's hanging out by himself. He's doing stuff by himself. And, well, I mean, right off the bat, he finds this seemingly abandoned dog and decides that he needs a dog. He needs a companion.
Henry's loner status marks, I think, all of the Henry Huggins books. He's constantly living in his own head, but he's not. It's not as though that's a sad thing. It's more like that's just his personality. I mean, later in the series of books, he will develop close friendships, but he's always the motivator of his own action, and he's always we're told he's kind of a restless, bored kid. He thinks that things don't happen to him. Of course, these books are just a series of one nutty incident after another.
Right.
But that's one thing that I think the Henry Huggins books give to children is that sense of control over your own life, over your own culture. You make your own entertainment. You make your own life. I wish there was more of that for kids these days in a way.
No, it's very noticeable. And it's something that I talk about with my own kids, which is this idea that you have to leave a kid to, you have to let a kid be bored. That's something that's been proven by child psychologists. You have to have a child has to have boredom because out of boredom is what breeds creativity. It's what allows people to create. And I think that kids had a lot more boredom. We're allowed to be bored a lot more as you go back through the decades, just because there wasn't, I don't want to sound like one of those old like kids in their phones type people, but there is something about not constantly having entertainment or not constantly expecting your parents to supply you with entertainment that breeds invention, that breeds this kind of creativity. And I think that Henry is supposed to kind of stand as the ultimate example of that. He doesn't have brothers and sisters. He doesn't have close friends at this point. He's just sort of wandering the city and making not only his own fun, he's making his own future. He's building his own world around him.
This is taking place in 1950, and what you don't see in this book is any exploration of the larger world of post-war America. I mean, this is just 5 years after World War II. This is in the beginning of the Cold War, and the Korean War is just around the corner here. The grown-ups in this world are off in their own world, and they're not really concerned with the kids very much. You know, that it makes sense in a way that, first of all, I don't think Cleary would have thought that talking about the wider world was that appropriate for a children's book, at least at this point in her career. But also, the kids in this book really exist. You know, it's almost like Peanuts. You know, where in the Peanuts cartoons, you never see the grownups except a couple times when Schultz did that in the 60s, and it was absolutely horrifying to see the kids and the parents. So that did run through, I think, the children's culture of the time. You know, now that I think about it, I think back on a lot of children's television shows, and the kids kind of lived in a parallel world to everyone else.
Yes, parents didn't feel the need, or weren't presented as feeling the need, to be completely involved in every aspect of their children's lives. And that was, I mean, when we talk about it, I presume later, when she wrote the Leave It to Beaver books, seem like they would have been a natural extension for her, because it's that same kind of world. And now, how realistic that world was based versus how it was constantly being portrayed in media. I mean, I want to believe that she's presenting an authentic view of childhood, at least her interpretation of it, because, again, this is based a lot on her experiences growing up during the Depression, which would have been a completely different culture as well. But it is definitely a world where children are allowed space and freedom without a without concern from their parents or the people in the neighborhood. People in the neighborhood will keep an eye and make sure that you're not doing anything completely outrageous or wrong. But otherwise, you're kind of left to your own devices until the dinner bell rings.
The dog, Ribsy, Henry finds this stray dog. He assumes it's a stray dog who we're told is so thin that you can see his ribs, which is why he's called Ribsy. And he negotiates with his mom over the payphone that he can bring Ribsy home if he can get Ribsy on the bus. And yep. So this is the instigation of the first wacky situation of the book, where he's trying to get Ribsy on board a bus and being told that he can't bring a dog aboard a bus unless it's in a box. Yep.
And based more or less on an actual event that Beverly Cleary heard about when she was a child's librarian.
Right.
I guess it was a group of kids who were trying to get a dog on a bus, and she just changed it to just one kid, and history was made.
Right. Now, Henry is told that a dog can only come aboard the bus if it's in a box, and so, very literally minded, he finds a discarded cardboard box and puts Ribsy into it.
It's a shallow box.
Right, it's a big shallow box.
A very shallow box.
And he scoops up the dog and takes him onto the bus, and he's no dice.
And the image of Henry holding Ribsy in the box is iconic. It's one of the most iconic Beverly Cleary images. Like, everyone has seen this picture, drawn by
Lewis Starling.
Yes, Lewis Starling. Of Henry holding Ribsy in this flimsy cardboard box. To me, that was one of the images of childhood. Like this picture from this book. And it's only like a few sentences in the book, because it immediately doesn't work out.
Right. What one of the things I love about Ribsy here and throughout all the books is that Ribsy is a dog through and through. Quite often in children's literature, dogs are either smarter than dogs really are, or they're treated like members of the family in the way that dogs never are. You know, that they become like Snoopy, or they become like Martha in Martha Speaks or whatever. And Ribsy is just a dog, and he isn't a malicious dog, but he's not necessarily on Henry's side all the time.
No, he is. And that's one of the great things about the original illustrations, was that Ribsy is portrayed as very much just a dog, with sort of that sort of dog passivity that you see, like, It's going to do what you want it to do until it's tired of you doing it. And I have my copy of Henry Huggins that I'm currently looking at is the new edition.
Oh, God.
With the new illustrations, in which Ribsy is very much portrayed as a cartoon dog. Like, every image of Ribsy is Ribsy reacting in some large way to something Henry's doing, or aping Henry's facial expression. So when Henry is looking warily at the bus driver, Ribsy is staring warily at the bus driver. Like, it's I hate to use the word betrayal, but it's a betrayal of the actual story that we're reading, which is a boy trying to muscle a dog to do what he wants it to do, even though Ribsy could not possibly care any less about Henry's desires.
One of the wonderful things as the book goes on is Ribsy ends up, you know, being Henry's dog, but he never quite settles into domestic life. He's constantly misbehaving, and that becomes an important point, because so many of the plots turn on Ribsy doing what he's going to do. While these books don't have as much psychology as the Ramona books, one of the things that I love is that at every moment something goes wrong, we're given a brief description of what's going on in Henry's head, about him assessing the situation, about him wondering what he's going to do next. And the motivation of everything Henry does is very clear. And it's very true to being a kid. He's told he has to get this dog in a box, so he figures he will do it, and then he's shocked when the grown-ups don't accept that, you know. And I think that that's one thing that comes up again and again, probably more so in the Ramona books, is the way that kids make a good faith effort to negotiate the yes. rules of adult behavior, but adult behavior doesn't make any sense.
But it also is a prime example because Henry, of course, Ribsy's not allowed on the bus. So, you know, he's told he has to be in a, completely wrapped up or completely covered. And Henry keeps going back to this one shop to get materials to package Ribsy up to make him bus appropriate. And he doesn't give up. He doesn't ask for help or clarification or... He's given a rule, he's given a goal, and he sets out to do it. And I think that that's a very strong indication of what kind of person we're looking at here with Henry. He will not abandon his goal. He will not, once he's made up his mind he wants to do something, he will attain what he wants one way or another. He's not a schemer. He's very single-minded, and... he will continue to be that way throughout the rest of the books. This book doesn't have as much of an arc as the later books do. The later books will sort of present Henry with a goal at the beginning of each book that'll sort of carry over until the end. But in each chapter in this book, well, until some of the later ones, I don't want to say he's, you know, stubborn or pig-headed. He is just determined. And that's like one of his defining characteristics, is that he doesn't give up.
As you say, this book, everything's kind of more like more picaresque and more vignettes. Obviously, Cleary is learning how to write a book as she's writing this. And
well, she wrote the first chapter as a standalone story.
Right, right.
As just a story that she was trying to pitch to a magazine.
Right, right.
And then they were like, you should really write this into a book. And it kind of reads that way. Like it's six chapters that are each kind of a stand, except for the last one, which is weird. Each one's kind of a standalone. I kind of, looking back on it, I think it has like three solid first chapters. And then to me, the last three chapters get a little sitcom-y. But again, I think Beverly Cleary is kind of feeling her way around what makes a story work, what makes these characters, who these characters are. So I'm certainly not going to hold it against her as a writer.
On the bus, once Henry finally does succeed in wrapping up Ribsy, at least long enough to get him on the bus, he runs into Scooter McCarthy. Scooter is going to become sort of a rival figure for Henry throughout the books. And one of the things I like about Scooter is, as a kid, I remember feeling like I wasn't exactly sure what my attitude towards Scooter was supposed to be. Sometimes in children's books, an older boy character like this will be presented as a straight antagonist. But Scooter mm-hmm. is sometimes Henry's friend. Sometimes he's going to be Henry's tormentor. Sometimes he is an obstacle, and sometimes he is a help. It rings very true to some of the relationships I had with older boys when I was growing up. In childhood, you're constantly concerned with the hierarchy of the group, but the hierarchy is often determined by simply a year or two's different. And,
right.
And Scooter, he isn't like a bully or anything. He's just...
No. And I think he could easily have become a bully in another writer's hands. Going along with what you're saying, I think this is... And it definitely, of course, we're very isolated in this chapter, but it's that whole... When you're growing up, I mean, maybe not as much today, but certainly not as much today, but growing up, you were kind of... Your friends were the kids who lived around you. Like it or not, like your neighborhood kids, those are the kids you kind of played with. And there were jerks and tough kids and older kids. But when there was no one else around, those were the kids you played with. Like even the jerk would come to your house and be like, hey, you want to go to the park? You want to go hang out on the street? And you'd be like, yeah, of course you would, because that was a kid in your neighborhood and you were kind of stuck with them.
Of course, Ribsy is found out, because there's no reason a dog would put up with being wrapped up in paper for long. He scratches his way out, and for a moment, it looks as though Henry is going to be thrown off the bus. Then, if a sort of a Deus Ex Machina, a police car shows up and asks for a Henry Huggins because Henry's mom has been concerned about him. And it's a well-written segment because it captures the terror that Henry feels at that moment of being asked for by a police officer.
Yeah, am I going to be arrested?
Yeah. I once was pulled over on a bike by a police officer for going through a stop sign in my small town of Eureka, Illinois. And I still wake up in cold sweats thinking about that police officer turning on his siren on my little Stingray bicycle.
Oh, no. What did he do?
Oh, he just told me, if you're on a bike, you still have to stop at a stop sign. He was absolutely right.
Lesson well learned. It also is a nice way to say that, yes, in the 1950s, kids could sort of have the run of the neighborhood, but Henry's mom is still worried about him.
Right.
The parents aren't completely out of the picture, because the cops were called by Henry's mom, who was like, okay, it's taking my kid a lot longer to get home than it's supposed to, because Henry keeps getting kicked off buses is the point. And so she called, I guess the cops have been like checking each bus. Is that what we're meant to understand?
I mean, I don't know how many buses are going down this route in Portland at this time.
Suburban Portland. Yeah. But yeah, so he ends up getting taken home by the police and the parents are like, well, about time he got home.
Yeah. And they're very happy to see Ribsy because, of course, parents love it when you bring in stray dogs.
Yeah, a flea-bitten dog, literally a flea-bitten dog. This is also an era when you can just find a dog and bring it home. Like, there's no... they you find out later that they sort of, like, they put out a call to see, like, if anyone bites as far as this lost dog. Or they look to see if anyone's lost a dog. I can't remember what they say. It comes up later, but... It's theirs. There's no, you know, you find a dog, you bring it home, that's your dog.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on in this book. I mean, in the next chapter, which is about Henry taking on some guppies, the plot point hinges on the fact that at the end, Henry is able to just sell off his guppies. People just kind of shake on it and they just do deals that way.
Yeah. There's your neighborhood pet store.
Right.
And you know the pet store owner and you can do simple business transactions with a business owner without it being very complicated because it's 1950 and that's just a sign of the era. So second chapter, another animal chapter. The first three chapters in this book are animal focused.
Yeah.
They're kind of about Henry's relationship with not only with animals, but with money. It's three, you know, in the first chapter, you see him dealing with money to sort of negotiate how to buy the things he needs to get Ribsy home. In the second chapter, we're learning about Henry's relationship as with money, as far as like what happens when he gets caught in a situation where he's spent some money, he's used... How does he get the fish again? He's
going to the pet store to buy Ribsy horse meat.
Horse meat. Right, right.
Horse meat comes up a lot.
Beginning of our relationship with horse meat, yep.
Yes.
And the fish are on sale, right. You can get guppies for cheap.
Is it still horse meat in the new books? I was wondering if they would change that.
Yeah, they haven't changed. Like, the prices and everything in the editions I have, in these new editions, the prices and everything are still the same. He buys horse meat. Yeah, everything is... The skunk still costs $40. this is sort of a shady pet store. You could buy a parrot at one point, a monkey,
right,
and a skunk with its defensive glands removed.
Right. No,
you're not going to find this at Petco.
My mom used to tell me that when she was a girl, you could go down to the pet store every Easter and buy chicks that had been dyed pink, yellow,
yes,
and green. So
yes, I think they actually mentioned that in one of the books, or maybe in one of the chapters. Just the pet store at one point had chicks and bunnies at Easter time.
So I don't think that the same strictures were in place regarding the sale and care of animals at this time.
No, but you could probably guarantee that this is probably pre Puppy Mill. I don't know. I guess that Snoopy was from the Daisy Hill Puppy Farm, so someone was milling dogs at this point. But I want to believe that the animals were probably a little healthier than they got in like the 70s and 80s when that whole like the mall pet store thing got out of hand. But Henry gets some cheap fish. He gets some guppies. For 79 cents, you get two guppies, you get a fish bowl, you get a snail, you get a plant, and a package of fish food for 79 cents.
Yeah.
That's a pretty slick deal.
That is. Now, I had guppies growing up, and one of the things that happens right away in this, is, of course, is the guppies start having babies, which is very true to what guppies actually do. They're mm-hmm. extremely fertile fish. But what Cleary doesn't mention is that if you don't separate them, the adult guppies will eat the baby ones.
Oh, yes. So, indeed.
But Henry quickly has to figure out what to do with all these baby guppies. And so what he does is he gets a bunch of old mason jars and other canning supplies from the basement and starts filling them up with more and more guppies.
Yep, and eventually he uses up almost all of his mom's canning jars, and he has to get rid of the guppies, but his friends won't take them.
Now, one of the things that's important about this chapter is a lot of characters are introduced just kind of as an aside. This is the first mention of Beezus and Ramona, who, of course, become enormously important characters. But right now, they aren't. They're just kind of like mentioned as...
Yeah, we learned that Beezus is interested in fish, but you find out that the Cleary family has a cat and a bunch of other animals.
The Quimby. The Quimby family.
What did I say?
You said Cleary family.
You find out the Quimby family has... more animals than they will eventually have in their own books.
I don't think they even name them by their last name at this point. I think it's just Ramona and Beezus. And Ramona has almost no character at all in this story.
I wouldn't think she even would. She has to be so young at this point. You meet Mary Jane, who's the local like tattletale and prim and proper girl.
She's like Violet or Patty in the Peanuts things, in that she's this kind of a very feminine girl who kind of fades away from the story because there's not much interesting to say about her.
Yeah, all the characters kind of hold her in a little bit of disdain as it every time she's mentioned, you're just like, oh, she's the one no one really wants to hang out with.
Right, and there's Robert, who is completely forgettable, except that he is Henry's friend.
Right, he's the nice kid.
Right.
Yeah, he's the Shermy who's going to disappear as it goes along.
Exactly. So all these characters are introduced only to let us know that they can't really help Henry out with his fish. The clock is ticking because Henry's mom wants to start canning. She wants to put aside tomatoes and apricots and apparently blueberries and huckleberries.
Mm-hmm.
Did you come from a family of canners? My mom canned a few things.
Oh, no, I didn't. I never understood what was going on in this. I didn't understand. All I knew is that his mom needed jars, and I really hoped that she cleaned them out. Like, because she's like, Henry, I need those jars right now. Like, I'm cutting up the peaches right now. You need to bring me those jars. And I'm like, you're going to have to, like, sterilize these things. Like, this is disgusting. Living creatures have been swimming around inside these things. I think you have to boil the jars. Like, you really have to get these things clean inside and out. They have to be sterilized in order to can properly anyway.
I believe that when you can, you actually boil what you're canning inside the jar, and then you put the top on to hermetically seal it to try so it doesn't become overgrown with bacteria. But it always, when I learned how to do that as a kid, I thought this is something I'm not going to do, because I can imagine the first time I do it giving myself botulism.
Yeah, it's gonna be ugly, especially if fish have been living in your jars. And you just throw a bunch of peaches in there. Now, one thing we skipped over was that when Henry got the fish, we get in my opinion, a little bit of a lengthy adventure where Ribsy steals the horse meat and runs off with it. It's one of those moments that I always forget is in this chapter, because it doesn't really have any... It shows you that darn dog... It also shows you that Ribsy's not doesn't really care about Henry's, like, isn't a cartoon dog. Henry's just a dog that wants to eat meat. And Henry expects Ribsy to carry the meat home in his mouth without that having any, without that becoming any sort of problem. So Henry gives Ribsy the horse meat because Henry has to carry the fish home. And Ribsy, of course, runs off with the meat and then eats it. And that's like, that's really all Ribsy does in the chapter.
At the end of the chapter, Henry decides he has to bite the bullet and divest his holdings of fish entirely. He goes back to Mr. Pennycuff at the pet store, and Mr. Pennycuff offers him $7 for the fish. I have a hard time imagining today walking into a pet store with a bunch of tropical fish and saying, here, what do you want?
I also think it's what Mr. Pennycuff says, these fish are worth about $7. I can't give it to you in money. And I'm like, why can't you just pay the kids $7? Like, just give the kids $7.
Well, you know, $7 back then, that must have been $5,000. No, I don't know.
Right. That would have broken. I guess I don't carry that much in the store at one time.
As the story goes on, it's fun to spot all these points where, like, this would never happen today because a lot of things hinge upon having cash on hand.
Yeah, so he gets $7 worth of store credit. He uses them to buy himself a catfish and a nice size aquarium and a pump. And he gets shown how to use the filter and everything. And a heater, a thermostat, all for $7. And he takes it home. I think it's interesting. You sort of get to know Henry a little bit as a kid who thinks about his money and who really likes animals.
In the next chapter, Henry and the Nightcrawlers, Henry has a new thing to save for, which is a genuine buckskin football.
And now this is the chapter where the premise to me it seems a little wonky. There's a little bit of a suspension of disbelief as far as how he gets into this situation. And then the deal, the reason he has to earn the money, the reasoning behind it never quite worked for me as far as whose fault is what and who owes what to whom. Also, Henry and the Nightcrawlers is probably going to be the name of his first band in high school. But so what happens is Scooter gets a new football that he wants to show off because it's expensive. How much does that football cost? Like $14?
Yeah.
Like this is that's a lot of money, like especially for 1950. His grandma gives him a football. No one else is around, I guess, so he invites Henry over to toss the ball back and forth across the street. At one point, Henry throws the ball and Ribsy barks. At the exact same time, a car is tearing down Klickitat Street. Its back passenger door is open. A window is down. At the moment that Ribsy barks, Henry throws awkwardly. The ball flies into the rear window of the car as it's driving by, and then the car just keeps speeding down the street, which is one of those things that I'm like, I guess it could happen. Like, it could physically occur. But to me, that's one of those moments that I was just like, that's a leap. Like, that's a lot of things happening in order to set up Henry needing some money.
From a authorial standpoint, what Cleary is trying to do is, she's trying to set Henry into a situation for which the readers won't blame him, but
right,
which you might believe that Henry himself would feel responsible for, to the extent that he would feel it's his job to replace this football. But one of the other things that doesn't work is that Henry is told by Scooter, you better replace my football or I'll tell your father.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yep. I'll tell my dad and he'll tell your dad and then you'll really get it.
Right. First of all, I don't believe that that's actually would cause too much problems for Henry. But halfway through the chapter, Henry tells his father anyway.
Tells his father. That's exactly what I was going to say. That's bothered me so much. His father asks what's happened and Henry tells him. And I'm like, well, doesn't that solve the problem? Because the only reason you're doing this is you don't want your dad to find out, which I think speaks more to Scooter's relationship with his father than it does to Henry. Like, the fact that Scooter's like, if your dad finds out about this, you're going to get the holy heck beaten out of you, because I assume that's what happened at Scooter's family. Like, it's a very strange situation. Like, if it's one of those, it's one of those things that authors talk about, that storytellers talk about, happening in movies and on TV shows, where if one character would just tell another character what happened, there wouldn't be a conflict. Like, if Henry had just gone home and gone, I threw the football and it landed in Scooter, like, then Henry wouldn't have this ticking time bomb. Like, there wouldn't be a count. Like, Henry may still have to pay for the football, but the whole point of this chapter is that he has to do it before Saturday. And I think Henry's father might have been, okay, well, I'll talk to Scooter's dad and we can work something out.
Again, Cleary is learning how to write a book. And
exactly.
And the other thing that doesn't quite make sense when I read it as an adult about this chapter is Henry's plan to make the money back to pay for this football is he learns that his next-door neighbor, Mr. Grumby, who will become a much more important character in other books, he likes to go fishing and that he wants to get his hands on some night crawlers and that he will pay 5 cents a night crawler to, and he offers this to Henry. Now, as an adult, I can imagine making that offer to a kid.
No, he doesn't offer him 5 cents a night crawler. He offers him a penny.
Oh, right.
A
sorry.
Crawler.
A penny a night crawler. Now he offers him a penny a night crawler and I can imagine an adult doing that. But if you then turn around and Henry comes back to him, 1,400 night crawlers. I don't think that Mr. Grumby is under any obligation to buy all of them.
That's okay. So what happens is Henry finds some night crawlers for Mr. Grumby that night. Mr. Grumby pays him, you know, however much money. He catches quite a few, 62 night crawlers. And Mr. Grumby's like, hey, you know what? You catch as many as you can. Some buddies of mine and I are going out. We'll pay you for whatever you catch. So Henry's like, okay, well, all I need is like 1,400 night crawlers and I can make 14 bucks. And so he asks to go to the park late at night where he knows they will have just, what is it, like?
They will have water.
Is it just rain?
I think they water the park or?
Well, so he knows the ground will be wet enough for there to be night crawlers. And he starts catching night crawlers, like hundreds of them. He gets over 400 night crawlers. And then his parents show up and they're like, dude, it's the middle of the night. What are you doing? And he's like, I need to catch like 1,000 more of these things. Will you help me? His parents are like, all right, we're not doing anything else for the rest of the night. They help their son catch 1,000 night crawlers. And, he needs like a couple hundred more in order to make up for however much money he needs. And, he ends up with 1,331 worms, takes them to Mr. Grumby. Like you said, you can't keep 1,300 night crawlers. They're just going to die. Like, these are living creatures. You can't just keep them piled up. They're going to be worthless to a fisher person, like to anyone going fishing. But he's given the money. Like, he's given the money. And then the next day, the guy whose car he accidentally threw the football into shows up at his doorstep and is like, are you the kid who threw the football in my car? Here it is. Sorry, my wife was dying or something. I had to get my wife to the hospital. Yeah. Couldn't stop. Here's your football back. He disappears. And then Henry's like, I'll go give Scooter his football back. And now I can buy my own football. It's the beginning of a couple of chapters where things just kind of turn out for Henry in the end. And to me, that's the weakness of this book. Just this, like, yeah, I mean, she's got to come up with a lot of different little adventures for Henry, but this is where there's a few too many, like you said, like little few too many like deus ex machinas that show up to help Henry out. Like, there's no reason it would have been a fine chapter, in my opinion, if it had ended with him just buying Scooter a new football. Like, he didn't have to end up with everything he wanted, but he does.
I'm thinking about this now, though, because I agree that as an adult, I find this quite unsatisfactory. But as a kid, I loved the fact that Henry both was able to make the money and reap some reward from that.
No, definitely. she's doing a little wish fulfillment. Like, this is, it's that, and, you know, and I have a problem with it as an adult. Obviously, as a kid, it's a totally different story. And she's giving Henry, because he's a hard worker. And it wasn't his fault entirely. Like, a car drove by with its window down. Like, so I guess it's her way of saying, you know what? He worked really hard. He deserves his own football. And so the guy shows back up with his football. Now, the next chapter is where I start really having problems with the story. Because Henry gets roped into being in the school's Christmas play. He doesn't get asked if he wants to be in the Christmas play. He gets given the lead role in a musical, much to his chagrin, in a show he doesn't want to be in, he has no enthusiasm for, I don't think he's shown any talent for or aptitude for. But because he's the main character in the book, he's given the lead role in the class light opera, they show it, operetta, how do they... It's an operetta about a visit from Santa Claus. He gets cast. He's been cast in plays before. He's always humiliated. He hates doing it. And we're given our first example in Beverly Cleary of, oh God, she's going to start talking about Native Americans. It's the 1950s. This isn't going to go well. I'm reading this to my kid. I'm just going to skip this part. Because he was cast as an Indian in a school play. What was his only line?
Ugh.
His only line was ugh. Because he was an Indian. And that's all the Indians have to... He wore a feather. He said ugh. And this is... So that's a totally separate thing. We'll get into that when we get into Otis Spofford. Like that's a nightmare of self-editing from a parent's perspective.
I mean, we should mention here, these are books of their time, and while they were,
oh yes,
and while they were, they represented kind of an advance in certain aspects of children literature, they are about a bunch of white kids living in the suburbs.
When I was a kid, this didn't rub me the wrong way when I was a kid, because this was still kind of what I was growing up with. Yeah, we did Christmas pageants in elementary school. I was cast as Mexico in our school, Christmas Around the World pageant, and I had to wear a sombrero.
Oh, no.
I mean, I was Mexican, so I was obviously the default, but, you know, it's very indicative of its time. It's just, it's hard to read to a little kid now.
It's a kind of a longer chapter, too, and it's a bit of a mess because it has a couple of very funny set pieces,
mm-hmm.
like when Henry wants to get out of his role, he has the idea that he's going to get his mom to lend him his typewriter, and he'll typewrite a note from his
mom. He's
going
to forge a note,
right? And it's hilarious, partly because it rings true to the kind of strange ideas you have as a child about what you can do and get away with. It also rings true to the way that typewriters were if you were a kid who used an old typewriter.
Incredibly difficult.
Right.
And he writes something he writes garbage words. it's one of the funny, you can't even read it out loud. It's one of the funniest things in a Beverly Cleary book. Just the way he writes this letter these two versions of it that are incomprehensible, and he actually sits there and considers it. He's like, no, I don't think this will pass.
I also remember as a kid when he finally decides to give up on it, the line is, no, this letter was not a finished product. And as a kid, I didn't quite understand why that line was so funny to me. Now as an adult, I kind of recognize it's kind of almost Austenian in its kind of dry humor.
And that's one of the things that gets pointed out, and I'm glad you said it, was that Beverly Cleary has an extremely dry sense of humor. And these books, not just from a child perspective, are entertaining. As an adult, that sense of humor comes through a lot more. Like, she knew how to set up a punchline and make it pay off, as subtle as they were. And it really starts coming through in these books. She's very wry. Her writing is very wry.
On the other hand, the chapter does kind of drag after that. The one thing I would say that I loved as a kid again was the Lewis Darling picture of all the kids working on the flats for the production, and sort of this sense of the whole community of mothers sewing costumes and this kind of that world. My kids did not go through that in school.
No, kids are the way it's set up now. It's very sectioned off, and there's the volunteer council that'll do all this stuff, and if you want to help out, fine. But most parents are busy, and I don't know. I like the atmosphere around it. It's the plot itself that doesn't ring true to me. Now you mentioned the Lewis Darling illustrations. The illustrations in my book are a nightmare. I just wanted to say that, like, literally a nightmare to look at. So I'm just going to leave that at there.
Right.
It becomes very Nickelodeon, I think. Henry's rehearsing. They're painting with real green paint. Scooter's up on a ladder. He challenges Henry. I bet your dog can't climb the ladder. Ribsy climbs the ladder. The teacher gets upset that there's a dog in the theater. Ribsy panics, knocks over the paint. The paint falls all over Henry. He gets painted green. Because he's painted green, he can't be in the play anymore. He's happy because he doesn't have to do what he was asked to do. We're laughing because a kid got covered in paint. I don't know. It seems very, like I said, it's very sitcom-y or very like 90s children's television. Like, it's wacky because he gets paint all over
him. I think the other thing that it is Cleary is trying to make in each of these chapters, she wants Ribsy to be a motivating force. She wants Ribsy to be at the point of confusion in the story. And it doesn't need to be that way. It didn't need to be that way in the last chapter when Ribsy barked and Henry threw the ball wrong. That doesn't really explain anything more than Henry just throwing the ball. And in this case, Ribsy didn't need to knock over the paint any more than it just could have been an accident.
I guess the reason I don't like the chapter is because it's about Henry getting out of doing something. And to me, that weakens his character. Like, if there had been a way that he had ended up having to do the show, but had found a way to make it his own thing, or had found a way to actually find enjoyment in it or something. But instead, it's just about him not wanting to do something and then accidentally ending up not having to do it because he got, like, his clothes and hair got messed up.
This is also, though, I think a theme throughout the Henry Huggins books and especially the Ramona books, which is adults expecting children to have reactions to the things that they value, or expecting the children to buy into the adults' values, and the children not wanting a part of that. And now I think later on, what marks the Ramona's books is they show much more sort of the ambivalence that children can have sometimes about these things.
Right. Yeah, the adults are set up a little more adversarial in this book than they will be later on, just in the sense that, well, I guess what bothers me is you don't cast a kid as the lead in your school musical without asking the parents. Like, what if they were busy that night? Like, what if they absolutely couldn't do it, or there was a reason, like the kid would be unable to attend rehearsals or something? I just, from a parenting perspective, if my kid came home and was like, I have to be the lead in the school musical, I'd be like, wait, where did this come from? Or or maybe they had been at, no, because his parents don't even find out about it because he keeps it secret from them until Mary Jane blabs.
When I was a kid, I wanted to be in more of the theater productions that I could be in. There weren't a lot of opportunities. Once I got to high school, you know, I would want to be in the musical. And you had to try out for those damn things.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
So then the next chapter is probably, to me, the sitcom-iest of all. Because it's about the local dog show in the park. And how Henry doesn't prepare for it and then ends up getting a prize anyway. I don't want to skip to the end. But
you might as well. This chapter, I will agree with you, is kind of so lightweight. I think that what is happening here is that Cleary had a couple of really good ideas at first, and once she decided to enlarge this into a book, she just kept trying to get another chapter after another chapter. I think maybe inspiration was failing her. Maybe she wasn't exactly sure how to structure this. I think, as you mentioned, the later books are much more structured around an overarching arc that goes through the entire book. This doesn't really have... I mean, the arc through this book might be considered to be Ribsy, insofar as he finds Ribsy, here are some crazy things that Ribsy does, and at the end, does he get to keep Ribsy?
And
so that kind of ties things together.
And this chapter is only... I mean, it's about a dog show. Henry wants Ribsy to win a prize. Ribsy is a dog and doesn't care. So Ribsy gets filthy the day of the dog show. Henry tries to cover up Ribsy's dirt with talcum powder, but it's pink, so Ribsy turns pink. Ribsy is aggressive and fights another dog and winds himself around Henry's legs with the leash during the show parts. Like, it's a legit dog show. There's judges, and the dogs are expected to, like, behave. And through the whole thing, Henry keeps not getting eliminated from the competition, even though Ribsy is just being awful. And in the end, there's two big prizes given out, like best of show, and then, like, what is it, most unusual dog? And I'm like, I don't think that Ribsy was being unusual. I think Ribsy was being a dog and an untrained and undisciplined dog. And
well, isn't the most
that's kind of
isn't the most it. Unusual for him being pink?
I don't know. Like, to me, that doesn't seem very like the dog's pink. Like, I don't like to get as big an award as best in show. Like, this is a bit you in a big cup, like a big like silver cup.
This is another chapter that speaks to a kind of a different time, insofar as it's a time where there is a lot of civic activity going on. There's like a dog show that's just a community dog show that people are going to show up to. It's crazy. This is not the way dog shows are. We're all familiar with actual dog shows where purebreds are brought up and they are expected to demonstrate certain criteria. But this is just sort of like, well, Portland's going to have a dog show. Everyone show up.
I was confused. Like, in the beginning of the chapter, I was like, oh, is this like a neighborhood like pet show? Like, bring your pets. Everyone gets a ribbon. It's going to be fun. Like, there's an Ezra Jack Keats book about that. I think. I don't remember. Edit this part out. But the notion of the neighborhood pet show where all the kids bring their pets and they show them off and some parents judge them and you get cutest, you get silliest, you get smallest, you get largest, and everyone goes home with a ribbon. But this one seems to actually be organized by like the local dog food company, or because there's judges and then it gets written up in the newspaper. And like there are several rounds of judging and very serious like judges with clipboards, like checking out the dogs and inspecting the dogs, seeing how they walk. The reason it rubs me the wrong way is it reminds me a lot of the previous chapter in that Henry gets what he wants. And in this one, he does it by just sort of screwing up into it. Like, he just sort of falls backward into his success, which doesn't seem very Henry Huggins to me.
Right, and both chapters hinge upon one of the characters getting collared.
Right. It's wacky. It's kind of wacky for the sake of being wacky.
Right.
And it's something that Beverly Cleary doesn't do a whole lot of in later books. And when it does happen, like in Ramona, when crazy things happen to someone's hair, it gets a laugh, but then there's like an emotional repercussion.
Right.
And in this... you're not getting a whole lot of the characters' inner emotional lives yet. It's still just like funny things that happen.
Sure.
But them winning this award, and again, not winning best in show, winning most unusual dog, Henry still gets his name and picture in the newspaper, which leads into chapter 6.
One of the things is that we were talking about before we started this podcast is we've both been reading Beverly Cleary's memoirs to catch up sort of on her life. Although, unfortunately, her memoirs only go up to the publication of Henry Huggins. So,
yeah.
But they still are quite interesting to read. In the last chapter of the second book, My Own 2 Feet, where Beverly Cleary discusses submitting the manuscript for Henry Huggins and getting the offer of publication, she mentions that the editor said that the existing final chapter was no good, and that it didn't work. And I found that fascinating because I, even as a kid, I always felt that this book didn't really have an ending, a clear ending, so much as it just sort of stopped. And in some ways, there's something remarkable about this final chapter, because about the first half of it is devoted once again to the idea of children sitting around being bored, trying to figure out what to do with themselves. And it's like Henry, Robert don't know what to do, and they're bored, and so they decide to go bother Beezus and Mary Jane, and they don't like being bugged, and they tell her to go away.
I'm dying to know what her original draft of this chapter was. So in the introduction to the edition of Henry Huggins that I have, there's an introduction by Beverly Cleary where she kind of tells the story of coming up with this book. She says in this version of the story that her editor wrote back and said, would she consider making some changes, particularly in the last chapter? Of course I would. The changes turned out to be minor, even in the chapter, which was quickly straightened out with the help of Elizabeth's tactful suggestions. So in this, she makes it sound like there were only a few changes in the ending, not like a complete rewrite. But in other versions of the story, it sounded like the last chapter didn't work at all. And that was the big thing that she had to change. So I'm wondering how different these two versions were, because my opinion of the last chapter is it's the one that really seems to have been meddled with. It seems like a compromise. Like, we listened to the audio version read by Neil Patrick Harris, who does a great job. If you have to listen to the Henry Huggins books. And I talked about this chapter with my 5-year-old who finds it very distressing. But she said that she liked the fact that there's no bad guys in this chapter, that all the kids, even the kid who comes in and presenting the problem, who is unnamed, like he's just this strange boy, shows up. He's nice. Like, everyone's nice. Everyone's trying to help each other. And I'm wondering if when Beverly Cleary wrote this chapter, maybe the strange kid who shows up was more antagonistic, or I don't know, because the whole thing seems, it's nicely done for what it is, but it's a little flat.
Ribsy's former owner shows up. He's seen Ribsy's picture in the newspaper, and he knows where Ribsy is now. And so it becomes a question of who gets to keep Ribsy now that a year or so has passed since Ribsy has gone missing from this kid's life. And there's kind of an argument back and forth between the kids about what constitutes ownership here. And the way it's decided, I think, is, again, very flat. There's no twist to it in a way. It's interestingly enough, you know, we've talked about the wackiness of some of these earlier chapters. This is a very dry story. It's sort of like the beginnings of an idea of a chapter, and then you have to figure out what is the hook. And Cleary never kind of comes up with a hook.
Well, I feel like that's very probably a part of the rewrite, and also the idea that you have to bring this. This is the kind of ending I would expect if the Henry Huggins adventures had been made into a movie in like the 80s or 90s. Like, you would have thrown on this ending where, oh no, Ribsy might get taken away. The neighborhood rallies together and they keep Ribsy from getting taken away by someone. But A, the kid who comes back claiming Ribsy has a firm claim on Ribsy. Like, it wasn't through his negligence that Ribsy ran away. He left. He had to go to scout camp. Ribsy escaped. And they're like, well, why wasn't he wearing a collar? He's like, Ribsy was wearing a collar when I left. It must have come off like in the time I was gone. And they're like, well, obviously Ribsy didn't like, but this kid is nice. And he was apparently a good pet owner. And he has a claim to this dog. Like, it's not that he was mean or negligent. It's just stuff happened and the dog got out. And now there's this conflict. And I can understand why they would want to present it that way, because it doesn't make it easy, but it also leaves the ending, to me, feeling very emotionally ambiguous. Like, I'm not sure I feel that happy for Henry, because this, what happens is they do the classic, you stand on one end of the sidewalk, I'll stand on the other, we'll both call to Ribsy, and whoever Ribsy comes to will be the owner. And of course, there's some drama, but then Ribsy ends up going to Henry, and the kid's like, oh, well, can I come visit every once in a while? And then Henry says yes, and then we never hear from this kid again. And I can only imagine that kid going home and going up to his parents and being like, oh, guess what? I found Ribsy. But the other kid gets to keep him because we did this stupid game. And just being furious as a parent and being like, no, we're going back. We're getting that dog. That's your dog. Like, I don't care what game you kids played. We're getting Dizzy back, and we're putting him in the car, and we're taking him home because that's your dog. I feel like it wasn't justified. I feel like the ending's not justified. Like, I feel really bad for this poor kid.
I'm curious as to sort of what motivates this chapter, because, I think that Cleary is trying to figure out a through line through this book. And I do think that that through line is sort of the entrance of Ribsy into Henry's life, the way that Henry's life changes because Ribsy's there, and then this kind of moment of crisis where Ribsy might be taken away from Henry. But I don't think that this is a problem that is implied by the rest of the book, that Ribsy's owner is going to show up at any moment. And introducing it does produce this kind of a moment of where as a kid you feel ambivalent about over what has happened.
I understand that she needed an ending to the book, and I don't think this is the one it needed to be. Or if you wanted this to be the ending, then there had to be more of the book had to lead up to it a bit more. Like, at least at some point mention that Ribsy's owner is out there somewhere, or we don't know if, you know, like, if someone comes up looking for the dog, we don't, like, Ribsy's not a huge part of the book. Like, he only shows up when you need some dog antics. And then the second to last chapter is kind of about Ribsy, but he's not Henry is the focus of this book, learning about this kid and making the last chapter about the ownership of Ribsy seems kind of contrived to me. I don't know.
There is one point I wanted to point out here, though, that I found fascinating, which is even though all of the kids in the neighborhood are kind of just embryonic characters at this point and not much is made of them, Beezus tells the other kids when she's irritated to get off her property, and Scooter says, this isn't your property. And Beezus says, well, my dad rents it. So it's just like having property. And that's fascinating to me because it'll be another 20-odd years before we get to the Beezus and Ramona books, which do hinge very strongly on issues of the economic situation of the family.
Even though these are middle-class families, and they don't seem to be, you know, struggling, you're given hints throughout the book that that money is an issue. Like, the kids aren't just given things. And that comes up in later books, like when Henry's trying to get a bike. The parents just can't drop drop 10 bucks on something. Like, and I think this chapter does introduce us to the fact that there are kids in the neighborhood whose parents don't own their homes outright, which is it's telling as after their situation. Because this is a time when home ownership was a really big deal. I mean, it still is a big deal, but the idea of the American dream, the 1950s, the post-war generation, you know, home ownership was a huge status sign. And Also, this is a chapter where we do get to see the kids in the neighborhood rally together and Scooter stop being a jerk because one of the neighborhood kids needs assistance. And so Scooter comes to Henry's aid. And it gets pointed out, like, Henry is taken aback that Scooter would help him. But it makes sense because this is the neighborhood against an outsider.
Now, I agree with all that, and I still feel a little ambivalent about this chapter. I felt ambivalent as a child, and as an adult, I feel even more ambivalent about the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
But reading the book through, you see a lot of what you came to love about Beverly Clary in these glimpses into the interior life of children treated with a lot of seriousness. Mm-hmm. Henry, maybe we don't agree with his motivations. Maybe sometimes, you know, as you say, it's frustrating when Henry just wants to kind of get out of something rather than to try and either transform it in some way or, you know, move it in a different direction. He just kind of, he would like to slack out of these things, but we're invited to treat his anxieties with compassion and seriousness. It's not as well developed in this book as it will become, but it's there from the start. And the mm-hmm. other thing that I think is there from the start is what you said earlier about kids creating their lives and kids taking responsibility for who they are and what they're doing, and kids working through problem of being bored.
And I think that I agree with that entirely. And I think that Beverly Cleary at her weakest is an incredibly strong writer. In these beginning steps, she's showing a remarkable sympathy for children, a remarkable respect for their emotional lives. Like, she didn't grow up in an era when children were considered, where children were considered. Like, it was very much, she grew up very much in a children should be seen and not heard kind of world. And I think that that fed into her desire to treat children with the respect she felt she wasn't afforded as a young person. And just the ability to hone in on what makes kids work and what makes a kid's day be a kid's day as opposed to an adult's day. This last chapter, we see them trying to pull off gymnastic tricks. Is this the one where the chapter begins with the gymnastic tricks? Hey, let's do that thing like the guys at the gym. You see a lot of just kids being kids in this chapter. Robert tries to spin Henry like the guys at the gym, whatever that means. Beezus is trying to walk across a tightrope with Mary Jane. Ramona's just hanging out with them, being Ramona. And then Scooter comes riding up and crashes his bicycle because he's trying to show off. You get to see a lot of kids being kids. And I think she'll find a better balance of that in later books. Like, she'll be able to, she learns how to incorporate that more into the momentum of a plot than just kind of stopping all the action and showing kids doing their thing. But it's already there, this realization that this part of a kid's life is as important as the adventures they get into. Like, this is as much a part of Henry and his friends as the big showdown at the end, as the dog show, as the adventures with worms. And I think that's just a brilliant part of her writing. I do also want to note that this chapter explicitly draws helmets on all the kids riding their bikes firmly in the new editions, firmly setting these books in the 1990s or early 2000s, when they are clearly narratively not set in those eras. Another thing that happens when you try to update Beverly Cleary's writings to the modern time, it looks false. It looks phony.
I cannot understand the desire on the part of book editors or on the owners of movie properties or television properties to take these stories and modernize them. Obviously, there are things that are disagreeable and horrible. I mean, I'm not going to defend when Roald Dahl is racist in one of his books. I'm not going to defend when in the original Hugh Lofting, Dr. Doolittle has an absolutely horrific bit of racism in it. But why do you need to excise the actual lived experience of these kids at the time? As a kid, you know, I picked up this book and I was only at that point 25 years away from this book. But I could tell immediately that this was about a time that was different from my time. And that was part of what attracted me to this book.
And when I first started reading her books, I was aware that they were set in a different era, but I didn't care. And my daughter doesn't care. Like, she knows that fish don't cost 75 cents. She's been to Petco. She knows how expensive things are. But it doesn't bother her because the stories ring true. And she's very invested in them. We're reading as we go through them for this podcast. I will be going over them with her. And beyond the horrifically racist stuff in the Otis Spofford book, there's nothing in here that doesn't sit right with her as a child. Like, it's all just, kids haven't changed that much in the last 60, 70 years, as far as like their internal life goes. And that's what these books are about, the internal lives of these kids.
Thanks for listening to the inaugural episode of Click It Cast. Click It Cast is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more podcasts at theincomparable.com. And join us next time when we go digging for beats with Ellen Tebbets.